Success number 28776, Real 7.
I'm also Aaron Nigel, Real 7. With these operations against German airfields, was it an attempt to really get the German fighters up occasionally?
Well, I think it may have been, but from our point of view, it was better to keep them down, to destroy them on the ground, which is the best way of destroying aircraft, really. And that, as I say, we had some success. We were quite often, we had to abort because for various reasons over which there was, it's a classic example of the kind of things that go wrong in operations. After this episode with the Nabob and Trumpeter, we went back into Scapa Flow, and without our knowing it, fuel from the Trumpeter or the Nabob, whichever Nabob, let's say, was transferred to Indefatigable, gasoline fuel. And I remember one evening, we had a pilot, I can't remember his name now, and he'd gone roaring down the deck to take off, and the engine stopped. And he just managed to stop the aeroplane before it went off the front end, and turned right here. And everybody believed that he'd forgotten to turn his fuel on properly. And so the CO said to me in the evening, "Ray, would you go up and run that aeroplane, see if you can find out what's wrong? I don't think there's anything wrong with it. You'll see what you can... Well, you give it an engine run, give it a test." So I remember going up in this undress, Scapa Flow, and I couldn't start this engine. It would not start. So I had to come down and say, "Well, I've tried, sir, but I'm afraid I can't get it to start." So I told the engineer officer about this when I got out. I said, "Well, I can't make it start." So they started looking at it, and the carburetor was full of water. And when they transferred this fuel, they had transferred a whole load of water with it. They'd pumped water over. And so we had contaminated fuel. So every carburetor in the whole, through all the aircraft of the ship, had to be taken off, washed out, cleaned out, and then the fuel had to be strained through chamois leather to make sure there's no water going into the aircraft. And I mean, this takes ages. And so that whole operation involving that particular time had to cease. We had a Barracuda that went off and went straight into the Ogden, and that obviously was contaminated fuel, and then we'd had this contaminated fuel. So that whole operation had to be cancelled because we had contaminated fuel. The other time, I tell you, we ran out of tyres. There were events like this, and of course, quite often the weather was too atrocious to fly. I mean, you couldn't fly. There wasn't much point in flying. But that was the main main activity, and of course, life within the ships went on. I had that accident I mentioned through turning out, and there was a staff officer we had at that time who was not a very nice character. It's in my book, I think. But anyway, he made some remark about my flying ability, which I didn't take very kindly. And so I decided, well, I'm going to have to confront this chap because it's gone too far. So I went down to his cabin one evening, and he was surprised to see me. And I said, "I'm getting a little tired of your remarks. And if you make one more remark, I'm going to hit you. And that may lead me to being court-martialed or something not rather nasty, but I'm sorry about that, but that's what's going to happen." "Oh," he said, "I didn't realise that." I said, "Well, you have been getting under my skin, and it's got to stop, or else I'm going to strike you, whichever way you like. Doesn't bother me." Never happened again. Now, it was, you know, the classic example of how to deal with the bully And because all bullies will back down in the end if you face up to them, because they've got nothing behind them, usually. But that was an unpleasant experience. But he was an unpleasant chap.
Who was he making the remarks to? Was he making them to your face?
To me,
or was it to
in front of other people. That's what...
Was it done in a normal... Was it meant to be in a joking manner, or was it a semi-serious manner, how he was making
it? No, it was, oh, well, I suppose you're going to have to fill in another accident form, you know, and all that kind of... It was vicious, and uncalled for, unnecessary, and it certainly lacked any fellow feeling, but not surprisingly, I suppose, but he subsequently killed himself. In an accident of some kind. I can't remember how it happened now, but it did. And funnily enough, I took over his job as staff officer, but...
Because I could imagine that would be quite an undermining thing to actually say to pilots who are flying operational things.
Right, but it's in an enclosed community. You're living cheek by jowl with people, and that kind of thing can really screw you up, and does. But it was a good lesson to me in a way, and as I say, he wasn't such a hot pilot himself because he killed himself. But it was an example of what happens in having people living cheek by jowl. If they don't, you have to be very tolerant in a society like that, or it won't work.
It sounds very interesting, actually, that kind of enclosed squadron society, because you mentioned earlier the kind of drinking culture that existed while in Northern Ireland. Is that a release from operational flying?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, I think a lot of the chaps that had a very rough war, and those didn't have too much of a rough war. I mean, if you were inclined to drink, then, of course, it would take control of you, I suppose. If you weren't, then, you know, you were reasonably safe from that particular aspect. And a lot of the chaps who, obviously, we never thought about it or talked about it, but they became alcoholics, obviously. I mean, alcoholism wasn't something that was talked about quite generally. I mean, it was only in the post-war years that people started talking about alcoholics and alcoholism. But that's what they were, without a doubt. I mean, and it's always the Navy, because of its ability to have drink on board, and for people to have, if they're so inclined, not much else to do, it became, you know, one of the difficulties of life, I suppose.
I suppose as well it's one of the few forms of recreation that you could have in that enclosed environment.
Yes, it was. It was that, you know, have a drink, have another drink, have a drink with me, have a drink with... You know, it became a... And before you knew where you are, if you weren't careful, then you could be drinking too much. I mean, fortunately, as I say, it wasn't any kind of virtue on my behalf. I never really liked it. I never really liked beer. I didn't drink beer to this day. I mean, I'll occasionally have a glass of lager, but I don't really like it in the same way as I didn't smoke. I tried to smoke. I didn't like it. And so it wasn't any kind of great virtue on Ligo's part. I was just lucky that I didn't like it, and therefore I didn't do it, and therefore I didn't suffer from the consequences of it.
I have heard described on carriers as well that smoking was very, very prevalent in that day and age as well.
Throughout all the ships. I mean, right up until... Don't forget that their lordships and their generosity were providing sailors with duty-free cigarettes on board. And in shore establishments, you've got 200 duty-free blue liners, they were called, a month. I used to give all mine to my wife, because she smoked quite a lot. But I never did, but I mean, how the Navy got away with it. But as a result, you'd find all the bulkheads were kind of a yellow colour, because they were all stained with nicotine from the, you know, ships. And most of the dirt in ships was ash. When you had a ship's company of 1,000, 2,000 smoking, I mean, you can imagine the dirt that was caused by this. But anyway, that's...
You mentioned, obviously, a little bit about singing earlier on as well. In the, I was thinking of the evenings, how people would pass the time, as well as drinking and smoking. Would the, how would they...
Not so much at sea. I mean, but once you had finished an operation, come back and go into harbour, into port, and the ship had shut down and everything, then you could have a kind of sing-song around the piano, if you had luck enough to have anybody who played the piano. And yes, that was a form of recreation, and endless songs about naval aircraft, all of which were most of the Barracuda, which was had more songs about it than any other aeroplane.
I'm thinking of on the operational times where you're up in the Arctic. Could you take me through the process of what happens when you were going to go on an operation, really from the briefing period to the return and the debriefing?
Yes, you would first of all be briefed on. I remember being briefed an attack on an airfield called at Hammerfest, which is the most northern airfield in Norway, right at the very tip of Norway. And one is shown the briefing, which were done by the ops officer in the ops room, would consist of course, the map of that part of Norway, where the ship was going to be, where you would hit the coast, and how you would determine that that was where you should be. You'd be sent on a course from the ship to the coast, then pick up some landmarks, and then fly towards the airfield, which would be 10-20 miles inland or along the coast or somewhere. And then you'd have a photograph of the airfield as it was, not maybe... pardon me, as it is now, or was at that minute. Then they would try to locate on that the gun positions, etc. I never forget the first time I flew over an airfield being told by, I said, "What do you like? We'll be flying right over the main gun now." I said, "Oh, thank you very much." Oh, they said, "That's the safest way to fly. I never hit you if I don't believe that one." Anyway, and then you would see where the aircraft would be, and you would have this one flight. If you had a, I mean, some COs or flight leaders would think, well, that was the Vickers run, turn around and do it again. And that was always a bit then, because you'd now stirred up the wasp's nest. but most people, thankfully, would say one strike is enough, and then I'm out. The thing I remember being impressed about Hammerfest was in the briefing being told, well, you see this building here, yes. Well, don't attack that, because the Germans are using that as a brothel, and they've got Norwegian women in there, and we don't want you to... I mean, that really struck me as a youngster. I mean, God almighty, what kind of people are these? And so you would be briefed, and then you would fly, and then you would find, hopefully... I would be flying in those particular days. I was flying into CAs number 2 and flying tucked in behind him or alongside his wing, and then we'd start the attack on one run, firing whatever we saw that was worth firing at, out the other side, full bore, throttle fully open, and away down to the south in our case, where we'd deliberately go south to give the Germans the impression that that's where we were going, and then we go south until we were well out of any radar coverage, and then we turn back towards the ship to recover. And in those days, just the ship was not transmitting. What you had was a beacon which you timed with a watch. You had a stopwatch, and you synchronized your watches, and there would be, you'd listen out on a certain frequency, and you'd hear beep, and then you'd check with your watch, and depending on what time that was received was the bearing of the ship, and that was the way you found the ship. You didn't find it, as the case may be. Thank goodness, whenever I flew, we always did find the ship back. But it was radio silence. So you would go in at very low level, 50 feet, and you'd come herring out at very low level. and back to the ship. But having always taken avoiding action to the extent of not exactly showing, because if you turned around and went straight by Allegan, they'd know where the ship was.
When you're attacking at that kind of height and at that kind of speed, how easy is it then to identify targets on the ground?
Not easy. I mean, either they're going to come up in your field of view. I mean, you might decide, okay, just as we approach the airfield, we'll pull up to 100, 200 feet, so they've got a better view. Then in we go. But you haven't got much room for manoeuvre. You're more or less committed to an arc of fire. And so you look within that arc of fire for something that is worth attacking. A gun position, hopefully an aircraft, a hangar, a fuel depot, vehicles, anything that was worth attacking.
Is it an exhilarating sensation to come in that low and that fast and attack
no,
an
I don't,
so I
like
don't, that?
I don't think it's particular, because if you've got it right and you surprise them, there isn't much coming at you. I mean, the first time that you actually see tracer fired at you is frightening, I think. And you think, oh, Christ, you know, look at this, and there's this tracer flashing around. The great thing to remember is if you're seeing it, it's almost certainly not going to hit you. And so you get used to it, in other words. It's like during the Blitz, walking about in London, the biggest danger was from shrapnel, you know, whistling all around you. And I mean, if you got hit by a piece of metal that length of time, I mean, that was the end of you. I mean, no question, if it hit your head or any part of your body, you were in danger. But I mean, I think after a while, it's like with Trace, you got used to it. It didn't bother you anymore, because you hadn't been hit the first time, you hadn't been hit the second time, so you had a belief that you weren't going to be hit. But no, the best way of getting at targets, obviously, was to say, oh, well, we know where they are now, we'll turn around and go back. It's just a minute. I mean, you know, this is not, you no longer have the surprise element.
Generally, were the Germans surprised with virtually all of the attacks?
Yes, I mean, we'd go in at very early, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever time, very early. Or at a time when we thought they'd all been, have got their heads down or not got their heads up yet or whatever. And normally we achieve surprise. Normally.
Was there any feedback at that time as to damage you may have done?
No. No, and not that I was ever aware of. I mean, the only way you'd have established that would have been to have a photo reconnaissance aircraft fly over and see what had happened. But we didn't have any in the fleet. And we had them, but not in the fleet. And therefore you'd be looking at them. And the RAF, it would have been difficult for them to get. It was a hell of a long way to go.
Because it sounded earlier, the intelligence that you actually had when you were describing the brothel area,
yes,
the intelligence about the airfields was quite detailed.
Well, you were getting intelligence from Norwegian people who were feeding back information to you, and you relied on that to a very large extent, obviously. And so some of it was very detailed, some of it not so, but generally speaking, from my experience, it was fairly accurate. I mean, and if you fired at a ship alongside, I mean, you'd see your tracers going in and coming out the other side. You'd know that you'd actually damaged the ship. So, well, you'd certainly hit it. I mean, whether you'd hold it enough to let water in and whether you'd hit anything vital remained to be seen.
And I was thinking of the attacks when you made the airfields. Attacked the airfields. Were you able, you personally, to remember targets that you hit? Did you see?
I remember seeing targets and firing at targets. Yes, I remember those aircraft and hangars and anything that really moved. Really, what we were all a bit tight about was getting rid of all our ammunition, and then if we were bounced, we'd have nothing to shoot back with.
Would you then measure the amounts of ammunition that were fired? Would you give a certain set of
No, I mean, you know, by the length of time you had, you know, you couldn't, if you just sat with your finger on the trigger, you'd, the whole lot would go. So, you know, you're going in one lot, and then you'll save it for something else.
And with, did you have any difficulties in locating the carrier in any of those operations, or was it always easy to find?
No, we never seemed to. Mind you, I was in those early days. I was generally tucked in behind the CO, so he found his way back and I followed him. But later on, when I became a flight commander, by this time we were in the Pacific, and I mean, we had enormous formations of ships, four carriers, and two battleships and cruisers, and oh, Christ, it was, you couldn't miss it. And we were really doing high cover anyway.
With the attacks, though, you mentioned being tucked in behind the CO. Would that be the kind of position for a newish pilot to adopt?
No, it wasn't really, because what the CO wanted, being a fairly clever chap, was a reliable chap to be with him in case he was bounced, to keep his eyes out for him, to be a good support for him. And you establish a very personal relationship. I mean, he knew that LIGO was always there. And he didn't want to change it for Jones or Smith or Brown, unless he was forced to, and then he'd get to know somebody else. But that was it was a fairly senior position before you... I mean, the next thing was to become a section leader, and I became a section leader through the CO, which became, I mean, I became the number three. Flew on the other side of him was my own number two.
And in that formation, how would you fly that formation if there was four?
Always a finger four. Always a finger four. One, two, three, four.
Had that been adopted? Is that the, am I right in thinking that was the originally a German tactic that had been adopted?
The original RAF tactic, I believe, was three, and that was just, it was found to be disastrous. And so they went to a finger four, I think during the Battle of Britain and afterwards, and we merely adopted it.
Was it a satisfactory formation, do you feel?
Yes, it was. I mean, it gave mobility because you had two pairs, two twos, that could move about. The second pair could weave from one side to the other side, keeping a good lookout all the time to see if there was anything else about, and so it gave you a good flexibility and support.
You've touched on there, obviously, weaving around and looking around. Again, how important is it to always be looking around when you're in
an aircraft? If you're a fighter aircraft, it's extremely important, because the big worry always is back to that basic training thing. You're going to be bounced, and somebody's going to come up the back of you, and you haven't seen him, and that's when you're going to get shot down. So you've got to be looking all the time over your shoulder to make sure there's nobody trying to get at you from behind.
And when doing that, is that fatiguing during those operations?
Oh yes, it's tiring. And of course it's very easy to become lethargic about it, to stop really looking, and to concentrate on something else. That's when the discipline comes in, to discipline yourself to constantly be looking out for anything else that's about. And the best pilots and the best ones of survival and in aggressive tactics were those that kept the best lookout.
Operating in the Arctic, obviously the weather is a major factor there. What types of weather would you operate in, and what types of weather would you most distinctly not operate in?
Well, if there was visibility, I mean, you had you've got to navigate across ocean and then hit a coastline and then find an airfield. Well, I mean, if the coast, if you land going under 600 feet, 800, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 feet, well, you want to make sure the weather was going to be suitable for those kind of operations. Now, you were never sure, because you didn't know. You had what the Met man would believe the weather would be, but until you got there, you weren't sure what it was going to be. As far as over the sea is concerned, well, you know, if you had 500-600 feet and reasonable visibility, then that was all right. It was usually fairly smooth. It started to get very bumpy when you got over the land. So there was a variety, but what you were looking for in operations was, what was the weather going to be like when you got there?
How easy was that to predict with
them? Not easy. I mean, all the Met officer had was his charts to look at to see what he thought for a typical situation the weather would be when we got there. But there was no one reporting from Norway saying it's 500 feet and cloud visible. No, I'm sorry, I didn't have any of that.
And were there any occasions while you were operating up there that got out by the weather?
There were occasions when you'd suddenly get to war and you think, no, this is not on, we're not going to do this. And usually when you were briefed, you were always briefed for alternative targets. And those usually, in our case, were attacking shipping in the leads, because there, you know, you could fly down the lead. They've got to be careful you didn't turn up a blind alley. In other words, a valley, and there's no way out of the top except climb up, and you were into cloud, and then you've got to get back.
Because that must present quite a difficult situation, I'm thinking, in Norway, with the terrain is very, very similar, isn't it, in many respects.
Yes.
Was that easy to navigate around?
Well, once you knew where you were to start with, but if you, I mean, it was so similar that you could easily get lost. I mean, at that time, when we were up there, they were having great fun and games with the heavy water program. And there was one on my charts that I've got stowed away somewhere, are still marked this particular fjord. We weren't allowed to fly up there because that would alert the Germans to the fact that we knew there was something there that was worth attacking. They wanted that, the fact that we knew what they were doing, not to be clear to the Germans, because there was many films about that since.
And when operating in the Arctic, was there a problem landing on at all?
Not normally. I mean, there was. These were big carriers. There wasn't all that much pitching, and if there was, you had a batsman there to help you overcome that and to bring you steadily. And he would be watching the pitch of the ship, as I said, he was batting you on to judge the moment you came on. So the batsman was a fairly key figure in those days, and we were fortunate in fact having two very good batsmen.
With the batsman, do you have to implicitly follow his directions?
Well, yes, you must do, although there's always a reaction. I mean, if he suddenly says you're too low, by the time you got that message, don't struggle a bit, pull it, because you've got to, otherwise, you know, you'll stall. There may be a delay, and then you may be going, then he was saying you're too high, so you start coming down. So following the batsman's signals when the deck is, but the secret of good batting would be not to overcorrect you, but to say when he arrives at the point of touchdown, the ship will be in this position, and I'm going to bat him into an approach which will bring him onto that position, regardless of the movement of the deck. That was the secret of batting, and some were good at it and some were not so good at it.